You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Midori House in London, coming to you live from Studio One, I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, from Mexican pledges and Panamanian breakdowns to promises to curb drone strikes in Pakistan, we'll run through the day's big stories with Dr. James Boyes and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Then we change tack and look closer to home. We'll look at how a group of skateboarders have sent London's urban planners flying. All that, plus our correspondent in Belgrade, Guy Delaunay, runs through the day's news stories on his beat. And to the end of the show, our culture editor Robert Bound gives his verdict on three books of the week.
Without sounding completely strange, it's got a bit of like the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre about it. It's sort of set right in the backwoods where you feel that inside every flower is a sort of slug waiting to come out.
That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So rather a lot coming up in the next hour here on Monocle 24. But first, let's have David Spencer with the news.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. A long-awaited first round of peace talks between Pakistani Taliban insurgents and the Pakistan government has taken place in Islamabad. Government negotiator Irfan Siddiqui described the atmosphere as cordial and friendly. Thursday's meeting was a preliminary round where the two sides were expected to agree on a broad roadmap for future contacts. On the eve of the Winter Olympics opening ceremony in Sochi, Russia has reassured all those attending the Games that the event will be safe. But Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Kozak says US warnings over the dangers of attacks on the Olympics are being checked. A senior US security official has warned some airlines and airports to look out for toothpaste tubes that could contain bomb-making explosives. The warning was not issued to the public. Meanwhile, more than 200 leading authors have sent an open letter to the UK's Guardian newspaper, saying that laws passed last year in Russia are a threat to creativity, which puts writers at risk. Addressing the International Olympic Committee in Sochi, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for the Olympics to be free of discrimination.
The Olympics show the power of sports to unite people regardless of age, race, class, religion, ability, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. The Olympics give us an opportunity to celebrate everyone's right to compete on equal terms, no matter what they look like and where they come from or whom they love.
In Syria, the governor of Homs says a deal has been reached with the United Nations to evacuate civilians from the besieged city. Forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad have been surrounding rebel-held areas for months, causing concern about the plight of civilians. Seven people have drowned after a group of 200 migrants tried to swim across to Morocco's Spanish enclave of Ceuta from the Moroccan territories around it. Authorities say 150 migrants of the 200 were stopped in the water, 13 were injured and are being treated in hospital. On Wednesday, the Italian Navy rescued more than 1,000 migrants from nine large rafts in the waters south of Sicily. French officials have destroyed 3 tons of illegal ivory seized in the past 20 years, in accordance with a promise from François Hollande to fight against poaching of endangered species. The 15,000 pieces destroyed, 700 tusks, but also jewellery and sculptures, are estimated to be worth up to 1 million euros. France says it's the first European country to destroy its stocks. It comes a few days before the opening in London of an international conference on endangered species. The World Health Organization has expressed its concern over a new strain of bird flu spreading during celebrations for the Chinese New Year. The H10N8 strain has now spread to humans in 2 cases, with 1 fatality. The previous H7N9 strain has seen around 60 people die in China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. But the latest strain is worrying authorities as millions of people crossed the country over the holiday period. WHO's China representative, Bernhard Schwartlander.
The influenza virus has the ability to adjust over time. And that adjustment can include The fact that it changes in a way that it transmission from one human being to another human being is possible. If that happens, then of course the potential for a massive spread, in particular in a place like China during Chinese New Year, where millions and millions of people are on the move, are together in trains, in planes, that potential of course is a serious threat.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'll be right back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. And the time here in London is 18:06, which means it's 13:06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Dr. James Boyes and also Oscar Guardiola Rivera, both regulars, of course, to Monocle 24. Welcome to the programme, gentlemen. Let's start in Mexico, where the president, Enrique Peña Nieto, has pledged to double his government's financial support for the troubled state of Michoacán, which is playing host to an ongoing violent battle between a cartel known as the Knights Templar and vigilante groups intent on enacting rough justice. $3.4 billion is the amount that will hopefully tackle Michoacán's need for better schools, hospitals and general infrastructure, which have been improved to combat the underlying causes of instability, i.e. poverty and lack of resources. But will Peña Nieto, known to some as the Great Reformer, really affect any lasting change? Let's start with you, Oscar, on this story. It's an interesting story because I guess in the West, when you kind of read about it, you imagine vigilante groups kind of battling, you know, these drug cartels, and you think kind of good in a way, you know, communities rising up. But we've seen what happens in places like Colombia. It very quickly leads to more kind of instability as you have paramilitary groups taking over. Before we dip into what the president's doing, what's your read on what's happening on the ground and how dangerous and fraught this is?
Very complicated, very dangerous. There are two types of self-defense groups which originated in Mexico in November 2011, more or less. One of them is the sort of indigenous-based, which to a certain extent follow the model of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, and they began in the state of Guerrero. But the Michoacán ones are pretty different. They have been organized for the most part by landowners and also traders who are being affected by violence, which means that here we may have a repetition of what happened in Colombia in the 1990s. And if things do get out of control, and, you know, when I was reading about, you know, the kinds of weapons that they have, the support that they have received from the army, and precisely this proximity between the state and these irregular armies, it does ring, you know, all sorts of alarms.
James, when you look at what the president's doing, he's kind of saying, OK, let's pour in money, build infrastructure, try and create some opportunity. Is that the right thing to do, the wrong thing to do? Is it a hopeful sign? Just tell me how you see that money.
The way you've introduced it, it sounded like a New Labour idea for a second. Let's throw money at the problem. You know, it's tough on terrorism, tough on the causes of terrorism.
That's brilliant.
I thought you'd like that. I'm reminded, actually, some of your listeners might know I'm just completing some work on the Clinton administration. And back in the day, his national security advisor, Tony Lake, came up with the idea of the rogue state, the state of concern. And I think that if Tony Lake was writing today, if he was national security advisor, he may well be inclined to put Mexico on that list. There's no doubt that the problem in Mexico is not new. It's not going anywhere. It doesn't appear to be getting any better. Certainly Americans I know who are from Texas are very concerned about this. And one wonders if there was perhaps a more robust administration in Washington, D.C., whether they might not end up declaring this a clear and present danger to national security in the United States, with the great risk of cross-border terrorism, perhaps.
Oscar, it's great that the Texans are worried, but let's be honest, the misfortune of Mexico is to sit between the big producers and the big market often for drugs. You know, they're the go-between point head for drugs heading north. Is there much that Mexico can really do, as James said, until the Americans kind of face up to their responsibilities and their security issues as well?
Well, at this point, I'm not certain that there is much that anyone can do. And I also fear a potential response by a more robust American government of the kind we had in Colombia. Mm-hmm. You know, Plan Okay. Colombia was, in terms of human rights and the actual conflict, a total disaster, even though some might argue that it had some results on the military side. It's very unlikely that something like that will happen in Mexico's case. And actually, if anything, the circumstances on the ground seem to me much more complicated than the ones we saw in Colombia in the 1990s. So if I were a Texan, I lived in Texas for 5 years, I would be very, very concerned.
Mm-hmm. James, you know, the interesting example there of Colombia, we're in a situation now in Colombia where, you know, we are seeing negotiations with FARC, with the main mm-hmm. rebel group. But when you look at something like the Knights Templar, there's not really anyone you can negotiate with, is there?
Well, I wouldn't imagine so. And it wasn't a coincidence. I use the expression clear and present danger, of course. That was the Tom Clancy novel that was basically a fictionalized account of what happened in Colombia. Yeah. There's no doubt when you start dealing or considering dealing with these types of organizations, A, you have to make a conscious decision to engage in those conversations, which certainly nobody in Washington, I think, is in any place to do anytime soon. And certainly when you do start down that route, who do you deal with? As you were rightly saying, who are the leaders of these groups? And is there any degree to which that isn't going to change anytime soon? So I think it's a real, very fluid situation. And again, you know, I think to reiterate the point, if you are in Texas, stay on that side of the Rio Grande.
Well, the leader of one of the groups is known as Papa's Morph, which tells you exactly the kind Excellent. Of people we may be dealing with. Obviously, what journalists on the ground are saying is that there is a clear proximity between these groups and the army, which means that the state seems confident in the fact that they might be able to, sort of create a strategy to take one of the main cities where the Knights Templar have been strong, quite strong. But the problem, again, is the people. The people here in Michoacán, as it happened in Colombia, are in between two armies, armed to the teeth with the biggest guns. They are going to be the losers.
Oscar, just before we quickly move on, how do you explain the kind of the mystery of Mexico in a way that, you know, here you have a country that's doing incredibly well economically, and if you go to Mexico City, it is a very different story. You know, actually, the security doesn't feel any more dangerous than, say, in other Latin American cities. You certainly don't feel more at risk than, say, in a Rio or a Sao Paulo. How come there is this kind of, like, this two-tier country being run?
Not a mystery at all. I mean, if you went back to Colombia in the 1990s, you would have seen an economy which was doing pretty well for Latin American standards, but there was plenty of violence. The point of the matter here is that we now live in a world in which peoples are sharing the same space, but they might as well live in different planets. The ones who are benefiting from the economic boom and those who have to live in a world that is increasingly becoming, sort of dystopian sci-fi film.
Well, we're going to move slightly south in a minute, but my guest today, Dr. James Boyes, who's an American political historian, and of course, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, who's a Latin American expert and also the author of The Story of a Death Foretold, The Coup Against Salvador Allende. And we're going to head now to Panama, where talks between the Spanish building contractor SECA and the Panamanian Canal Authority have reportedly broken down, with work on the expansion allegedly halted, although the Spanish are currently denying this. The talks were set to resolve a dispute over who should foot some $1.6 billion worth of extra costs incurred in the project. So what are the implications of this impasse? James, start with you. When you look at something like this, you know, it's a huge kind of negotiation. We know the Spanish government has been involved. They've been trying to kind of negotiate some deal. You have a company that really feels it can't kind of cover all of these costs. What happens in a situation like this, and what should happen in a situation like this?
Well, you know, we're talking about one of the major world arteries. I think there's an awful lot of people perhaps here in Europe who are in the dark about this story. But what this is an attempt to do is to basically increase the capacity of this waterway to take it, so they can take material taking 5,000 containers to 12,000 containers. So this is not a small operation. One of the problems, of course, is that you've basically got one of the world's great arteries basically being held to ransom, it would affect. And one can almost imagine why it is that there'd be some people in Washington scratching their heads and saying, why did we ever relinquish control over this? Thank you, Jimmy Carter, effectively. You see, you can blame everything on Jimmy Carter if you take this down far enough. It's a fascinating relationship between the United States and Panama. Teddy Roosevelt became the first American president to leave the United States in office. And there's actually a photograph of him in a big dugger in his white Panaman suit digging the Panama Canal down there. So I think there will be people saying, you know, why on earth do we leave the Panama Canal to be run by Panamanians? This is what you get when you relinquish control like this.
And for the Spanish, Oscar,
you know, he'll be smiling, Dieter Weir, I should point out at this point.
There's lots of these companies, you know, from Italy, from Spain, who've had a bit of a tough time in Latin America. Certainly they've been run out of town in Venezuela. They're looking at huge debts here now in Panama. Do they think, actually, oh, we should have left it to the Chinese after all?
Well, that might be the case, actually. Let us not forget that there is an ongoing project for another canal in neighboring Nicaragua, and the Chinese are behind it. And they now think that they will begin construction in late 2015. So there are already signs for competition. And actually, that might be good because you know, all these problems with the canal do tell us that, to continue with James' metaphor, actually, if their artery gets clogged, the entire world economy might have a heart attack. And this would be the worst time for something like that. Spain carries no negotiating power. The Spanish government in Latin America, given its current travails, economic and otherwise, has no diplomatic strength. The Panamanian president was absent from the CELAC meeting, which is also problematic. That kind of isolation in such an important negotiation is bad news for us all.
And just a few words, Oscar, before we move on. Just tell me, you know, the state of the nation for Panama, you know, a country that was, again, a failed kind of narco state, was, you know, we saw the Americans go in there and sort out what they wanted to happen. But actually, in the last few years, Panama hasn't done that badly. It's got a regional airline that people kind of admire. It's connected Panama to lots of places. Is the country kind of doing well?
Well, it also has a shady financial system, and you know, Colombian drug dealers do love it, of course, and a government which, for all intents and purposes, is isolated diplomatically in the rest of the region. Again, he didn't show up in CELAC, and his friends in Colombian politics, for instance, are on the losing side of politics. So this might spell the final problem for the country. Some might say, to disagree with James a little bit, that problems began in 1903 when Teddy Roosevelt decided to break Colombia into two and invented Panama.
You're welcome to disagree with him every now and then. We're going to take a short break now, and you're listening to Midori House, of course, with me, Andrew Tuck, and also Dr. James Boyes and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. When we return, we'll talk Argentina's devaluation and America's drone activities abroad. Stay tuned.
The morning show for North America's East Coast is a pacey roundup of the day's main stories. The briefing features informed news reporting, prescient business analysis, and invaluable industry reports from all around the world. Each day we're joined by an expert. Monocle's correspondents and industry insiders are in studio for analysis of the aviation, technology, defence, media and luxury retail sectors. Our friends at Bloomberg and Reuters in London and New York make sense of the latest markets, business and economic data.
I try to avoid the term perfect storm, but it applies so well here that I can't avoid using it.
That's a briefing every weekday at noon London time, 7 a.m. East Coast, here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is the American political historian Dr. James Boyes and the author and Latin American expert Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Now, in a moment, we'll ask where the curbing of America's drone program in Pakistan will leave the US in the region. But now let's stay focused on Latin America for a moment. In the last 2 weeks, Argentina has experienced a devaluation of its currency at such a rate that the 2002 crisis no longer seems that far away. Oscar, when we look at what's happened in Argentina, you know, in a way, it needed to let its currency slide a little bit, and it was overvalued. Everybody knows that, and in some senses, I think some people are thinking this is the first kind of hint at kind of the kinds of things that the Argentinians really need to be doing.
Actually, that's a very good angle. Most of the media have been very wrong in their take on this story. This shouldn't be blamed on the U.S. on the slowdown of quantitative easing. It should not be blamed on the basis that what is happening in Argentina is the same that is happening in Venezuela. These are two very different economies. What is happening in Argentina has a lot to do with the amount of soya that has not been sold. There is a sort of exporters blockade. They are forcing the dollar because that would benefit them, of course. But on the other hand, this might be the beginning, as you pointed out, of the kinds of reforms on the financial system, which are much needed in Argentina's case.
James, an interesting time. The finance minister has been kind of making some headlines, and the president, obviously following her brain operation, has kind of been out of things a little bit. What's your reading of what's actually going on the ground? But this is a country, even though we are kind of being a little bit generous here, that it goes leaps from one crisis to another over the last few decades.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you raise the spectre of the Kirchner's brain surgery, and that's almost quite a great metaphor for what's going on there. Let's think about what's happened. The country sold more than 8% of its foreign reserves. That's about $2.3 billion. Foreign reserves have reached their lowest levels since 2006. There's no doubt that we've got major economic crisis within Argentina. And I think it makes you realise, you know, why is there been saber-rattling so much over the Falklands situation? Sitting here in Europe, when you remember when the Falklands situation arose in 1982, a lot of that had to do with domestic issues. And I think what we're seeing here is, again, the same sort of ramifications. You've got an Argentine government who is very much in economic shtuck. So what's the easiest thing to do? Let's try and divert attention and talk about the Falklands. But you can see why they're doing it. They're silly trying to do something similar here. They're in an absolute financial mess. And it's fascinating, I think, that what you've seen is a skyrocketing of government spending up about 45%, but it doesn't appear to be having any dividends for the citizens or for the country as a whole.
Oscar, why is it so difficult to turn around Argentina? You look what happened in Brazil, you know, the success of Lula, even now under Dilma Rousseff, the country seems to be, you know, pretty good at kind of managing its affairs and not kind of having to attack the middle classes or blame the poor. It kind of brings most people along. Why is Argentina so different?
The specificity of Argentina's politics and economics has to do with the divide between rural areas and urban areas. So the kind of redistribution policy that Cristina Kirchner and her husband have attempted, you know, to a certain extent, you could say have been successful in urban areas, but rural areas have not been democratized. I did mention the fact that soya has not been sold. I mean, we're talking about millions of tons, and this is the main source of dollars for the economy. It is, you know, last year 90% at this point have been sold. This year only 80%, and is coming down. So it is this divide, the fact that landowners still hold economic and political power and have been impervious to the kinds of reforms that the Kirchner government has attempted does explain the specificity of Argentina's case. This is not to say that there haven't been any mistakes on the part of the government. Certainly, its focus on getting rid of its enemies, for instance, you know, the El Clarín newspaper and so on and so forth, and the Falklands issue do distract from what matters, which is economics. Let's hope that they are now focusing on what needs to be done.
Well, finally, in this part of the show, let's look at North America's fight against not just terror, but anti-American sentiment in Pakistan and the Middle East. Obama's foreign policy has been underlined by an increased presence in the skies above Pakistan and the region with drones. The use of deadly drones has, for now, though, been curbed because while the Pakistani government is in talks, it doesn't want these attacks taking place. It's trying to negotiate some peace on the ground with the Pakistani Taliban. James, you know this story well, and you know the machinations and sure. The push. And what's your read of what's happening?
It's fascinating, isn't it? The Americans under Obama have been very, very eager to withdraw from Pakistan, from Iraq and from Afghanistan. Freudian slip there, of course. What is fascinating is how it is, I think, that Pakistan has really been a major hurdle for the United States in that part of the world. Under Musharraf, of course, it allied itself with George W. Bush. But then guess what? Where did we find bin Laden? Surprise, surprise, over the borders. There's no surprise about why it is that the United States has been actively involved in the use of aerial technology in that part of the world. It's the real growth area and might actually end up being Obama's real sort of legacy issue. What you're seeing, I think, is an attempt to sort of withdraw from that part of the world generally. He's making this concession. But where it's moving to is a series of land bases across North Africa. So don't think that drone use is being retired anytime soon. What you're seeing, I think, and this fits in with the NSA narrative, is a president saying one thing about, yes, we'll take it nice and easy, I'm a good Democrat, whilst at the same time, this operation will continue, maybe in a different phase in a different part of the world.
Now, we've always been told, James, that the Pakistanis have oddly tolerated the Taliban much more than they pretend. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they have any hope of negotiating anything with the Taliban, or do you think they kind of trying to just build up a world where they kind of get along and each kind of have their territories in a way?
Yeah, one wonders whether the Taliban can really be entered into negotiation with in good faith. I think if you look at what Sharif is trying to do in Pakistan, it's very much emerge himself as his own man, effectively. He doesn't want to be seen under the American cosh, for example. You're going to have a similar situation, obviously, emerging in Afghanistan, where the leadership there is very eager for the Americans to leave and to be seen to be standing on their own 2 feet. Let's see how long that lasts after the Americans leave.
And Oscar, your reading of US policy in the region, should we trust what the Americans are saying?
As James just pointed out, Obama is the successor of the Nixon-Kissinger style of foreign policy. Our fingers everywhere, our fingerprints nowhere. Everyone should read William Dalrymple's The Return of the King, which tells us a very similar story of what happened with the British invasion and occupation in Afghanistan. Exactly the same thing is happening. It's a failure.
And James, is it just too tempting having those drones up there? You know, that you're not sending your troops in. You see a target, mm-hmm. and you know, just too tempting to put your finger on the trigger?
It's a distinct possibility. I'm thrilled to hear Oscar compare Nixon with Obama, because of course that's something I've been working on for a good 12 months now. But you're absolutely right. These things are being piloted remotely.
It's helping you sell books.
It is, absolutely. I'll provide a link for your website. And there's no doubt these things are being piloted remotely, and it is really much almost death from destruction from thousands of miles away.
All very interesting stuff. Thank you both, gentlemen, for coming on the show. That was, of course, Dr. James Boyce, the American political historian, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, the Latin American expert and the author of The Story of a Death Foretold, The Coup Against Salvador Allende. Plenty still to come, though, in the second half of today's Midori House, where we're going to round up the news from Belgrade with our correspondent Guy Delorney. And we're also going to discuss London urbanism with the writer Leo Hollis.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
But before we get started on any of that, here's David Spencer with the world news headlines.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed. Russia says the Sochi Winter Olympics will be as safe as any place in the West from militant attacks. That's after the United States warned airports and some airlines that toothpaste tubes could be used to smuggle bomb-making materials onto a Russian-bound plane. The first formal peace talks have been taking place between the Pakistani government and Taliban insurgents in Islamabad. Early reports suggest the long-awaited meeting was held in a cordial atmosphere. The Syrian government says a deal has been reached to allow what it calls innocent civilians to leave besieged areas of the city of Homs. Parts of the city have been under army siege since June 2012. The bodies of 8 mine workers have been recovered from a pit in South Africa after a fire and rockfall near Johannesburg. One body is yet to be found after the accident earlier this week at the Doornkop gold mine. It's South Africa's worst mining accident since 2009. Turkey's parliament has approved a controversial tightening of its internet controls. The legislation will enable web pages to be blocked within hours without a prior court order. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. And it's currently 18:31 here in London, which means it's 21:31 in Moscow and 19:31 in Belgrade, which is where we're headed now, because it's time to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And of course, today it's Guy Delaunay, our man from the Serbian capital. Guy, welcome to the show. And I think we're going to start with a slightly complicated story. So you'll have to give us a little bit of a background briefing. It's like one of those, a nastier soap opera. You have to kind of tell us the story so far. This is a strange arrest that's happened in North Kosovo.
Indeed it has. Now, with North Kosovo, let's remind ourselves here. There are four municipalities in North Kosovo which are dominated in terms of population by ethnic Serbs. They don't recognise the government of the Republic of Kosovo, which declared independence unilaterally 6 years ago. They say, we're Serbs, we're part of Serbia as far as we're concerned. Nonetheless, they were persuaded to take part in Republic of Kosovo mayoral elections back in November and again in December when they had to try again twice. And they've got a mayor elected who then refused to take office because he said he didn't recognise the Republic of Kosovo. You can see where that one's going. The guy who came second in that race was called Oliver Ivanovic, who's widely known as a moderate Serb leader, very well respected by members of the international community, has been a guest on Monocle 24 a number of times. Well, he's been arrested for war crimes, which Bango's one of my best contacts in North Mitrovica, and he's been taken away by the European Union Rule of Law Mission, which is based in Pristina, and he's been questioned about war crimes over the past week. And just today, another ethnic Serb from the north, Dragoljub Delibasic, who is a former police commander, has also been charged in connection with these offences, which all took place allegedly at the end of the 90s and start of the 2000s.
Now, I understand that some people think there's something a little bit fishy about the arrest of Ivanovic. Can you tell me why?
Absolutely. Well, I mentioned they've been having these mayoral elections again and again and again. Well, they're going to be giving it another go on the 23rd of this month. And of course, Oliver Ivanovic would have been a leading candidate to become the mayor of North Mitrovica. He's one of the he got down to the final two last time, didn't lose out by that much. And bearing in mind the guy who won it last time round has dropped out, another candidate has been assassinated and somebody else has also pulled out. It was a struggle to see who was a credible candidate beyond Oliver Ivanovic. Now, of course, everybody in the Serb community is saying, what's going on here? These are charges which date back, allegations which date back 15 years. We haven't heard a squeak about them so far, despite the fact we've had active war crimes tribunals, not just in The Hague, but also in Kosovo and in Belgrade. Oliver Ivanovic's name has never come into any of this. We can't see that there's any new evidence to suggest that he was involved. Why is this happening just a couple of weeks away from an election? What are you trying to achieve here?
Now, let's stay at the ballot box. Early general elections have been called in Serbia. Why?
Well, this is all about a consolidation of power by the Progressive Party. They're the largest party in the governing coalition at the moment. But their man, Aleksandr Vučić, who you can see interviewed in this month's Monocle magazine, indeed.
By a very fine journalist, I believe.
Bless you. Yeah. Well, he is only holds the title of First Deputy Prime Minister. Now, this has gone on for almost 2 years, and everybody knows that Vučić runs the country. No, he's been fooling nobody, and neither has the Prime Minister, Ivica Dačić. Everybody knows Vučić is the go-to guy. And finally, it looks like they're going to end this charade, because the poll numbers all say that the Progressives, if they go to the polls, will probably win a majority large enough not to need coalition partners anymore, or at least to be able to dictate very stringent terms to them. So this is what it's all about, finally making Vučić's role as the leader of the country official.
Okay, we've got 2 minutes left, and we're going to cover both of the final stories. Because I'm intrigued by the final two things you flagged up. Let's talk about why Vučić is Superman. Go on, 60 seconds.
Well, over the weekend, we had dreadful weather, minus 26, snowstorms, snowdrifts up to 4 metres high, hundreds of people trapped on the main highway to Hungary in their cars, as politicians do. Aleksandr Vučić headed up in a helicopter to address the situation and was filmed carrying a small child from the chaos. This has been responded to by people who are perhaps a little bit tired of Aleksandr Vučić being everywhere in Serbia by portraying him on YouTube as Superman, as various other kinds of superhero. The Snow Queen was another one that I saw. Anyway, they've been taking the mickey out of him, but some of these videos have been mysteriously disappearing from YouTube. So, of course, people are crying foul.
Guy, you did quite well. You've got 40 seconds now to tell us about Albania's mussels.
Albania's mussels. They're very rare mussels. This is the kind of seafood mussel rather than any other kind. Date shell mussels. Extremely rare. Some people think that the rarer the mussel, the tastier they are. This is all a bit of a shame, really, because you've got to chip them away from the seabed and from coral reefs, which is terribly damaging. Albania says that's got to stop, and it's also going to ban hunting into the bargain because its brown bear and eagle populations have been decimated in recent years.
There you are, the muscle men of Albania, revealed by Guy Delaunay. Guy, thank you very much for coming on the show. Guy, of course, is our man in Belgrade. Up next, we're going to explore an issue important to both fans of culture and also the city.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Now, skateboarder versus property developer. Who'd win in that fight? Well, those of you familiar with London's South Bank Centre will know that there lies a skate park underneath its performance spaces, bars and restaurants. The skate park, one of the oldest in the world, has proven a thorn in the side of those in charge of plans to redevelop this cultural institution. After a vociferous campaign by the park supporters, yesterday it was announced by the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, that the plans to transform the complex would not be realised if they included the removal of the park. The chairman of the South Bank Centre has since announced that they don't know what to do, and so they're going to pull the planning application. Well, to look into this recent development, we're joined by Leo Hollis, urban historian, and the author of Cities Are Good For You, The Genius of the Metropolis. Leo, thank you for coming on the show. The right decision, the wrong decision?
I think it's a difficult one. I think it's good to have this debate, and this debate came out of the fact that for a long time, since the 1970s, the skaters had been using this space and thinking it was their own space. And it was, you know, a place that attracted a lot of people who were interested. It was, you know, in some ways part of the joy of being on the South Bank. It turned out very quickly that when the people who run the South Bank wanted to transform the site, they needed to use that space in order to turn it into shops. It's going to cost £120 million to transform the South Bank, to modernise it, bring it into the 21st century. And part of that is going to have to be paid for by putting in shops and retail spaces and restaurants in the Undercroft. I think part of the problem that occurred was there was a bad dialogue, that there was no attempt to try and find a compromise between the developers and the skateboarders very early on. On top of that, we have a result which comes about from Boris Johnson, who shouldn't really have been involved at this stage. You know, he's come in a bit like Prince Charles in the 1980s and got involved in an argument which isn't his to have. The planning application was going to go to Lambeth Council this month, and then it was going to possibly be taken up to City Hall. But Boris came in and had a sort of, you know, in some ways, a sort of a mind splurge, which is...
That's quite a good word for Boris. Now, because they had discussed about moving it just a few hundred metres away and giving them the skateboarder somewhere else, which wasn't... The skateboarders felt this was like a historical point for them. More interestingly, I wonder if it tells us something about how we use the city now, you know, that these informal elements, you know, the way that things pop up, you know, the pop-up society, this has kind of popped up and stayed up in a way, that we kind of feel that the city is ours. It's not property developers to decide what happens in the centre of London, that we can reclaim streets and take streets and do things. I wonder if that's kind of healthy, though, that there is a kind of a breakdown in that kind of the old order of like property developer good, skateboarder bad.
Well, I think it's an example of something that has always occurred in cities, which is public spaces don't just exist. They don't just sort of sit around. They have to be occupied. They have to be taken. They have to be, you know, in some ways sort of protected by the people who use them. So, you know, the skateboarders owned that place by using it, not because they just sort of said this is a skate park. And so I think they deserve that sort of sense of ownership. It only causes a problem when the developers come in and sort of try and ramrod what is I suppose a sort of common law usage of the space. But I think there is going to be these conflicts everywhere, and I think they're becoming increasingly more prevalent everywhere, not just in London, but you can sort of see it in New York, in every city. As the city spaces become squeezed, public spaces no longer seem to be profitable in the way that the developers want them to be.
The other interesting thing is that there's so much harumphing that goes on around London. You know, there's all these kind of like people, security guards. You know, you go out to Canary Wharf. It's a privatized bit of London. And here, I wonder if it's just that they felt, you know, the South Bank people felt this is our land and we'll do what we want. You know, and what's interesting is I think people are getting a bit kind of irked by how much of the city is kind of off limits to them, or people are trying to make it off limits. And that's why so many people have backed, because, you know, let's be honest, the people backing the skateboarders would probably break their legs if they stood on a skateboard. But something about them, they became representative of this design, you know, not to let all of the city be privatised and taken over by these companies.
Absolutely. I mean, the South Bank is possibly the best public space in London that we have. I mean, that's what's so surprising about this debate, is that I remember just after the Occupy movement in 2011, Jude Kelly, who's the head of the South Bank, saying anyone who wants to come and use the space of the South Bank in order to organise, in order to use their meetings, to use the free Wi-Fi, this is the place, this is the, you know, the front public forum of the city. So it becomes, you know, extra surprising that then the focus on this, these very difficult lines between privatised and public spaces. But undoubtedly, when you look all around the city, for example, the new space that is just being developed around King's Cross, that is not public space. That is privatised space in which you'll be told how to behave by people in with CCTV cameras and people in high-vis vests. That's not what public space is about.
No, and I think what's also interesting is, you know, that you also see all these other examples of how there's a blurring of lines now between, you know, what we do in the city. Because I went to a big hotel in the East End of London that's just recently opened, Ace Hotel, and I was amazed at the weekend by the number of people who were kind of informally using it. They had kind of like pop-up offices there. They were taking meetings there. You know, you see, for example, Westminster retreating from, right, providing public toilets and things because it knows people use Starbucks to go for a wee. You know, suddenly, what's private and what's public, how we use the city, where we feel we can go, we're getting a little bit more, not aggressive, but, you know, we're thinking, actually, why can't I use this and why can't I use that? There's something kind of interesting, I think, happening about the metabolism of the city.
Yes, I think it's getting more confused. And I think it's partly getting confused because we spend so much of our time in public now thinking that we're in private. And we spend so much time when we're at home or, you know, in private thinking that we're all being in public. So all these boundaries are being rewritten, partly to do with information technology, with sort of social media. The fact that, you know, you can work now in Starbucks or, you know, you can work in a hotel lobby just with your mobile phone or a tablet. And so all these things need to be redrawn. And we are living in a moment when, you know, there is a confusion about this. And as a result, those who kind of own the land are going to be protective of it and perhaps overprotective at times. And those who, you know, want to use the city in brand new ways will be pushing the boundaries.
Final question. If I stick you on a skateboard, how are you going to do?
On flatland, great.
Oh, you can skateboard, can you?
But not downhill.
Did you come on your board?
Of course not. I surfboard.
We had a skateboard once in this office and I stood on it for like 3 seconds and I kind of crashed. But there was quite a good picture of me kind of balanced on it, which persuaded some people I could skateboard. I can't. Leo Hollis, a man who knows everything about the city and some things about skateboarding. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Well, we just heard from Leo Hollis on the momentary scrapping of the South Bank's redevelopment plans. And continuing on a reconstructive flavour, let's have some music. This is Talking Heads with Burning Down the House. And that was Burning Down the House by Talking Heads, of course. I'm not sure why our producer felt that, said something about skateboarding. I think it's just his favourite song. Anyway, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're fast approaching the end of the programme. But before we go, it's time for our daily review segment. And today, we talk books, and drop the E, we're talking real books. Our culture editor, Robert Bound, gave me his verdict on the three that caught his eye this week. Robert, thank you for coming all the way downstairs to speak to us about the world of literature. You've been a busy boy reading lots of books here.
Yeah, it's part of my new healthy lifestyle. You'll be surprised what you can do in the evenings when you're all in one piece.
Let's start with The Farm by Tom, very good, sensible middle name, Rob Smith.
Tom Rob Smith. They've sort of taken an amalgamation of some of the least and least liked members of the Monocle staff.
Now, this is a book that... It kind of delves into a world we know quite well, Scandinavia, and you know, we have a sense of what Scandinavia means now, thanks to all the Borgens and the TV shows and Denmark and Copenhagen and northwards that we've learned to love, the bridge and everything. What did you make of this book?
I thought this book was absolutely brilliant. This is called The Farm by Tom Rob Smith, and it's got a sort of sense of this sort of Scandi noir about it, but I don't think it's sort of playing to the crowd on this one precisely. Tom Rob Smith is half Swedish. Swedish. The novelist is half Swedish, and it's a sort of semi-autobiographical book. I realized sort of since I finished it. And essentially, the action is that this young guy lives in London, and his mother and his father ring him up. They've retired to rural Sweden, and they're one of those sort of super close families that always had a lot of affection for each other. He's an only child, etc., etc., etc. Everything seems to be perfect, and of course, it's one of those wonderful. Wonderful plots where the seemingly perfect world is sort of shattered very quickly, and the mother phones up and essentially seems to be accusing the father of all these sorts of things, and they move to this rural idyll in Sweden, and it's not basically what it turns out to be, and you're never quite sure. And it's fairly ingenious, the sort of plotting of this book, whether the mum's gone bananas or whether she's telling the truth. And so there's some pretty sort of dark moments in it. And it's kind of nice also that it's sort of set in, it's still in rural Sweden rather than in the sort of corridors of power of Copenhagen or Stockholm.
And tell me, so it's a little bit of a test of what parent you'd believe almost, whether you believe your father or your mother.
It is a bit like that, exactly. It is precisely like that. And it's a sort of like, you could almost set this sort of novel anywhere. It's kind of got a bit of a sort of, without sounding completely strange, it's got a bit of like the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre about it. It's sort of set right in the backwoods where you feel that everything is either beautiful or everything is very, very, you know, inside every flower is a sort of slug waiting to come out and now, bear its ugly head, you know.
There's a bit of theme going on here. I almost feel that we could be reviewing the books for Farmers Weekly, because the next book is also a bit rural. It's The Dig.
So The Dig, this is by Synan Jones, a Welsh novelist. I think it's his first full-length novel. It's almost a novella. It's a bit of a one-sit reading. And this is an amazingly powerful book. It's kind of got elements of, in terms of the style in which Synan Jones certainly has written this novel, there's a bit of Steinbeck about it. There's a bit of the Old Testament. There's a bit of Cormac McCarthy. It again is this sort of incredibly intense, self-contained world. And I think also the length of the sentences and the length of the book itself zero you in straight into this world, which is part of the Welsh sheep farming community. And it's basically the story of a farmer trying to get by and of a badger baiter trying to get by. So there is incredible cruelty, and the incredible cruelty that's meted out to some of the animals is echoed in the sense that this farmer is trying to get over the death of his wife, and the animal and the human and the earth and the people that inhabit it and use it to make ends meet sort of meld into one. There's a sort of bit of sort of creation myth almost in there as well. It's an amazingly powerful book there.
But a bit of a tough read. You don't put it down thinking, oh, I fancy a cottage in the countryside.
Just not in Wales.
Okay.
I've only said that because our producer's looking through the glass, Alan. I think there's a lot of truth in the book, or what you feel is probably truth. It's a bit like The Farm, Tom Rob Smith's book that we just talked about. It is this idea of something that is often portrayed as an idyll, and it shows the flip side to that. It shows actually how people in the UK and across the world in 2014 make ends meet, and there are some tough lines in it, but it is the most amazing, gripping story as well. And it's published by Granger, and I think it's quite an unusual book for them. I think they're quite a globe trotting, you wouldn't call them a trendy publisher, but this is very sort of hardcore, and it's a sort of very small but universal story told, as I say, in the hill farming community in Wales.
Now, for the final book, well, I guess you can keep your wellies on, because there's a bit of muck to wade through. It's the world. Look at that. It's the world of news. Yeah. But it's our philosopher friend, Alain de Botton, who's looking at the news industry and the reporting of it, not the receiving of it, not being on the receiving end, but how he feels.
Yeah.
What's gone wrong? What should be done in the world of news? And what was your take on this? I know that actually some of the newspapers have given him a right old drubbing. They don't like an outsider having anything to say about their world. And they've accused him of being kind of naive and not knowing the facts about what real journalism is. But what was your take on it?
Well, I think he's trying to redress that. I think he probably expected some pretty tough reviews from some of his counterparts in the more fast-moving world of the media that isn't philosophy. It's 24-hour news. news cycle. But what he's suggesting is that maybe we step back from that and we recalibrate our idea of what news is. We often think this when we're putting together a magazine every month and then we have the news cycle for the radio show every day that we're on right now. They're two very different beasts. And they kind of, and almost you use two different parts of your brain to be on the radio right now or the editor of the magazine we put together each month. And it's sort of that idea. It's this sort of two-speed reading of the news. But he's also sort of saying that for every bad news story that grabs headlines because it adds to the bad news myth of a particular country, of a particular person, of a particular part of the world, that balance can sort of be redressed. There are lots of other things to say about a place other than this. And I suppose one of the key things that I'd take out of the book is that it's a work of philosophy. It's called there's a subtitle of it is a user's manual, but it is a work of philosophy rather than a sort of how-to guide for newsrooms particularly.
Well, finally, Rob, from three different types of muckraking going on here, but which is the book that you'd probably pop in your satchel?
I think the user's guide to news is sort of, I would say it's essential reading for everybody, but those two novels are so, so strong. If I had to take one, I mean, I like to travel light. I think Simon Jones's The Dig is perhaps the one to take away with you.
Well, that was, of course, our culture editor, Robert Bound, talking to me a little bit earlier. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Dr. James Boyes and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Today's show was produced by Ali John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Rosie Sells, and our studio manager, that was Chris Chilvers. Next, after the headlines, it's my show, The Urbanist. And this week, I'm looking at religion in cities, from Harlem's booming tourist trade due to its gospel choirs to the urban boundaries that dictate where Jewish people can move things on the Shabbat.
I don't think it's about more or less strict or something, but it's about different interpretations and understandings. So there are some Jews and some rabbis who would say, I don't think this boundary is a boundary. We're not going to use it. And there's others who say, no, I think this is solid. It fits with the requirements of Jewish teaching and it'll do.
I'll be back with this show at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's time for me to say goodbye and thank you for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.